You're listening to the Washington Hospitality Industry Podcast, your primary source of information related to the hospitality industry in Washington State.
Well, good morning, everyone. We have a lot of people to get into the webinar. So while we're waiting for them, I will go through some basic housekeeping today. Good morning. Today we have Susan Shelton from the Department of Health, James Grigsby, who is a ServSafe Manager trainer, and Shelley Pemberton, who is the training manager here at Washington Hospitality Association. And we're going to talk about the Certified Food Protection Manager requirement in the new Washington State Food Health Food Code. But before we get into that, if you have any questions, go ahead and type them down in the Q&A. Once Susan and James have presented, they will be able to answer questions that you might have about these requirements and about the classes. We are also recording this, and we'll have your the presentation slides up on our website later on today. So if you'd like to rewatch this, if you miss any part of this, you can go back and check that out later on our website. Tomorrow, we have another very important webinar, the pay transparency requirement. If you are publishing job openings in any public spot, you have to make sure that you have your pay listed, potential pay listed on those. So Catherine Morissette will present this webinar, and it's on our members only site because it's exclusive for members. So if you go to Washington Hospital or wahospitality.org, you can find a link to that to register for tomorrow's webinar. Okay, with that, I'm going, well, more than happy to welcome Susan Shelton. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much, Lisa. It's nice to be here with everyone today. So again, my name is Susan Shelton. I'm with the Washington State Department of Health. I'm the technical lead for the food safety program. I am the individual that leads our rule revision. We use a stakeholder process in Washington, which means we take input from our legislature, all of our stakeholders, everyone that's affected by the retail food code, and use that to make changes to the federal model food code. So we'll be talking about one of our provisions today that is relatively new. We went through a rule revision from 2018 to 2020. Probably you'll remember back in 2020, we also started having a pandemic response. So it's been a little bit of a different kind of rollout. However, the requirement that we'll be talking about today is in effect. It is something everyone should be doing now. So I'm really thankful to be here and answer any questions that you all have, but also give you some highlights and hopefully some tips on how to implement the Certified Food Protection Manager requirement. You are more than welcome to reach out to me directly. I always like talking with members from the Washington Hospitality Association. Of course, if you forget my name, you forget my number, you forget my email, just reach out to your partners at WHA, and then they know how to get a hold of me as well. So again, really glad everyone's here along for the ride. I will cover quite a bit. As we mentioned previously, you'll have my slide deck. You'll be able to ask questions in the future, but then I'll also linger for the end. So in case you have questions in the Q&A, I'll be eager to explain those as well. So again, today we're really talking about the Certified Food Manager and also what we call active managerial control. So the rationale behind this requirement is that for about the last 20 years, we have seen that a Certified Food Safety Manager actually reduces the risks for outbreaks in restaurants. And so it's above and beyond the basic food safety training that we give for the food worker card. It's a lot more about the management style, you know, how to train employees, all of the additional language that you get from a Certified Food Protection Manager training course. And also then that certificate shows that you potentially have that level of knowledge. And we have seen through research that it actually reduces the risks of outbreaks inside the food facility. So the requirement for at least one Certified Food Protection Manager in food establishments in Washington State was actually added just in last year. So in 2023 is when it became fully required. And it provides you quite a few opportunities. So it gives you one way to meet what we call the demonstration of knowledge. Demonstration of knowledge has been a requirement for a long time. What that means is that the managers that are on site inside the food establishments are able to show that they are compliant with the code and compliant with controlling food safety risks. So traditionally that means that it's because when we go and do an inspection, there are no what we call red criticals, right? So there are no primary causes of foodborne illness. So your temperatures are correct. Your food workers are washing hands appropriately. All of the potentially using barriers such as gloves and tongs and handling food. We don't see any animals in the food establishment. Everything is working really well, and we don't see any what we call violations, but we also call them risk factors, things that cause people to get sick. So that's one way to meet it. You have no critical issues during inspection. Another way is that if you do have potentially some critical violations, then we could ask questions. Okay, so talk to me about what is required for hand washing. What do you have to, make sure all of your food temperatures are correct? So we can ask a series of questions. And if your person in charge, your manager, gets those correct, then they could also show that they actually have the knowledge. And then the final way is that you have a certificate. And so you are a certified food protection manager. So that's one of the ways that you can show, yes, I have the knowledge needed, or the manager, the person in charge has the knowledge needed to actually be responsible for the food establishment and be the lead. So one thing that we also adopted, though, was this concept of active managerial control. So we don't want it just that you have the certificate. For like, yes, I'm also implementing it. I'm also doing the things that I learned, the things that I was taught, and making sure that all the food workers here, all of our food, we're actually looking and making sure that we have managerial control. So we're making sure that we're doing exactly what we learned in class, and we're controlling the risks inside of this food establishment. So again, today's session is all about the certified food manager, both the certificate, how to get the certificate, but then also making sure that we're doing it when we're at work out in the field. I'll cover a little bit today. We have some material if you're interested in looking at it. A lot of it we've worked on with the Washington Hospitality Association, but we have things called toolkits. Copies of our code are on our website. This is a short link, doh.wa.gov/foodrolls, all one word. And so if you need any of the resources that we have, or you like any things that I'm sharing today, you can find them on that website. So really want to make it clear, when we adopted the certified food protection requirement in Washington state, this has been a federal requirement. Other states have been following it. But when we went with our stakeholder group and evaluated it, we received a lot of comment. Staff from the Hospitality Association were on our technical advisory group that helped us review all the comments that we received. And we made quite a few changes in Washington state. So I'd like to highlight those. So you might have coworkers or friends that work in another state, and maybe it's a little bit different. Again, it's because we made some modifications when we adopted this requirement in our state. One of the first requirements is that we changed the language so that it's one employee per establishment. So what that means is people that are in other states, some of the states said that they have to have a certified food manager for every shift. So that means that one of the persons in charge, one of the managers, actually has a certificate. They're on shift. So that means you have to have multiple. Because if people work different shifts, you have to make sure you always have a certified food manager. In Washington, we modified that. We said one employee per establishment. So what that means is the certified food manager is responsible for making sure everyone is trained, but they don't have to be there all the time. Now, what would we encourage you to have multiple certified food managers? Yes, but the requirement is that you have one per establishment. And we'll talk about the role of a certified food manager in a moment. Now, there are 10 nationally accredited programs currently accredited. And so we have lists there. If you were to Google, it's called ANSI CFP. So ANSI, Conference for Food Protection, ANSI hyphen CFP certification. That'll get you to the full list as well. But again, this list can continue to be added upon. There are quite a few providers. What it means is that they are approved to issue this certificate. So again, there are 10 that are nationally accredited. So you really, when you're looking for providing the certificate or finding the certificate, you wanna make sure that you're using one of the nationally accredited certification providers. Another item that we did is we gave a delayed implementation. As I mentioned, there was a little bit of a pause because of COVID. And so we did delay it for a year, but you'll see that delayed implementation was through March 1st of 2023. So now we're a year later. Everyone should have a certified food protection manager for their establishment by now. But again, we did have at least a 1-year delay because of COVID. We also added in the allowance to give you 60 days to replace a certified food protection manager. So technically, in the federal model food code, you're supposed to have one at all times. We understand that sometimes there is turnover. You might lose your certified food manager. So when your certified food manager is leaving or is gone, you have 60 days to replace it. It does take some time to do the training to get the certification. So we appreciate that. So again, you would have 60 days to replace your certified food manager. Hopefully you're able to make sure that you have staff that you have just a continuation so that you have staff that have the training, the knowledge. But again, you do have a little bit of time to replace it when you need to. Also, again, just to reiterate, the certified food protection manager does not need to be on premises. It's ideal that they are, but they don't have to be there at all times. However, you do have to have the certificate there. So if you're for an inspection, you would have to show the inspector the certificate of your certified food manager. It doesn't mean that they'll call them during an inspection. However, if we do see that they're having some food safety issues, we would expect to have that certified food manager able to respond to call and say, okay, how are we going to fix this long term? So again, they don't have to be on premises at all times. However, you do have to have the certificate there. And here's the kicker. The certified food protection manager is responsible for making sure all your persons in charge, so all of your leads, everyone that would be there when the certified food manager is not, your person in charge, your manager, your shift manager, your supervisor, whatever you call that role inside of your food facility, they are supposed to be trained and that they have the written plans that they are needed, that are needed. So we'll go over that a little bit more as well. So just because the certified food manager isn't there doesn't mean that their job ends. They have to make sure that the persons in charge have a very similar level of understanding and ability to run the food establishment. Because again, they have to have what's called active managerial control. And so we made those modifications to the certified food manager by saying, yes, you don't have to have one here on premises, but we want to make sure that that manager is training your other persons in charge. We want to make sure that your business always has active managerial control. So you'll hear us talking about this quite a bit. We added this into the definitions. We also added in as responsibility of the person in charge. What it means is that you're proactive so that you're looking for food safety risks and you're correcting them. You're not necessarily waiting for the inspector to say your temperatures are off. This cold holding unit isn't working. Your food worker is reporting that they're ill. You know, we're making sure that you are looking at your establishment and making sure that you're proactively controlling the food safety. And there are ways that we evaluate that. And I'd kind of like to hover and talk a little bit about what we call PTM. So we evaluate your level of active managerial control whenever we do an inspection. We check for certain things and then we figure out, okay, if things aren't working 100%, we'll figure out, is it because they don't have a policy or a procedure for this? Or is it because staff know what they're supposed to do, but they aren't necessarily trained to do it? Or is it possible that managers have policies, they have staff that are trained, but nobody's making sure that they're doing that level of work? So again, we call it PTM. That's how we evaluate your level of active managerial control. So I'd like to show some examples here. So let's say we are doing an inspection and we find that we have some workers that are unsure of symptoms of illness. So we ask, you know, can you talk to me about when you're too sick to go to work? And we'll try to evaluate, is it a policy issue? So there's no policy inside the food establishment. Is it a training issue? So the managers aren't necessarily teaching the workers, or is it because the managers aren't making sure that workers get corrected or that they're not monitoring it? So let's say I have an example where I have a worker that is unsure of symptoms of illness. And when we ask the business, they're like, well, they learned that in the food worker card class. Okay, so you're right. They do learn the principles of foodborne illness prevention in the food worker card class, but that is not the end of the training that's supposed to be done. So your business then would have to have, okay, this is our policy. This is our policy for how we make sure workers only work when they're healthy. It doesn't have to be written. It's good if it's written. It doesn't have to be written, but we're checking to make sure that it's like, yes, you're doing more than just making sure that they have a food worker card. Okay, so an example then, let's say you have a policy and we are still asking and the workers don't know. So like, okay, how do you train them? Maybe they need a poster, maybe they need some staff training at a monthly safety you know, meeting that you have or something along those lines. So yes, you have the policy, but your staff aren't aware of it. And then maybe you have the poster up, you've done training on it. And we're at the point of saying, okay, but they tell you that they're sick and then you're still having them come in. So there's a little bit of a management gap. All right, so I just kind of want to show you some of those examples. So when you're looking whether or not your facility has active managerial control, kind of think about that. You know, talk to your staff. Are you aware of the symptoms of foodborne illness? How about, are you looking to see if they're taking temperatures of food? And you're like, yes, we have a policy. Yes, you know, they're trained, but I'm still seeing that they have hamburger that's cooked to 148. How often do you go through and look to make sure that they are cooking foods to the proper temperatures that you have inside your policies and procedures? Maybe they don't wash hands after break. That's a big opportunity then for potentially for the training and coaching. So again, we're not trying to get you to, you know, really give workers a hard time, but it's a good time to actually go, okay, wait, let's revisit on when we're supposed to wash our hands and let's follow proper procedures for hand washing. So maybe some training is due or some coaching. Another concept is we go when we find that refrigerators are operating at 47 degrees, requirement is 41, so it's running warm. Your staff probably knows that food is supposed to be kept cold. You've probably trained them on that as well. So that's something where maybe we have a monitoring issue. So we need to focus a little bit on some of the monitoring. Maybe we have food that's being cooled in a pretty thick layer, so 6 inches. In Washington State, we look for a 2-inch container and uncovered. So now it's maybe this is what your business does. So like we like it to be cooled in deep containers because we have a lot of food, all right? That might be a policy that you have, but you would have to do some additional steps to make sure it's safe as well. And then maybe you keep temp logs. It's not required generally for most things that we make in Washington State. However, your business does, but then they're inaccurate or they're incomplete. So we would talk to you about the management and oversight there. So again, really just want to show some examples of what we're talking about. We require what we call active managerial control. It's really going to be key so that you're preventive and you're looking for food safety risks and then figuring out how to fix them as well. So I want to talk to you a little bit about what we call a toolkit document. On that website that I shared earlier, we have several toolkits. They're lengthy. I'll explain them a little bit more as well, but it's really designed to help you understand kind of the concept that we have for these requirements in our code, but then also hopefully gives you some tools to actually be able to evaluate your food establishment and train your certified food manager or make sure that they're doing the work that you hope that they are doing. So we have, again, there are a series of quite a few materials that we have. This one's specific to the active managerial control. It talks about ways that you can evaluate whether your facility has active managerial control. I gave you some examples there where we identified some risks, and then we try to determine if it was because there was a policy gap, a training gap, or a monitoring gap. There's a little bit of an introduction to the documents, talks about how to connect with your local health department because you can always work with them directly. Hopefully you do feel comfortable reaching out to your local health inspector, asking questions if you have them, either before you're inspected, but then also after you're inspected if you have additional questions. We've included quite a few procedures that are food safety controls inside of a food establishment. So things like health and hygiene, hand washing, how to use utensils, how to report illness, temperature control, using a thermometer, cooking temperatures, hot holding temperatures, cooling food procedures, thawing food, keeping foods cold, date marking is a new requirement that we have. And then we have some about contamination prevention. So produce washing, raw meat, keeping that separated, allergens, maybe those are questions that you all have and ways to actually train your staff, and then cleaning and sanitizing. So these are just key kind of common procedures that we see, but it would be something that I would encourage you to make sure if you're the certified food manager or you're working with one, are we training staff on all of these? Again, you're going to have unique procedures that are going to be very specific for your food establishment, but know that these are the common ones that we look for whenever we're out and doing inspections. These are the items that often cause the potential for illness inside of our state. Now, in the next section, we actually have some procedures that are required. You would have to have written procedures for these. So the processes on the right, or I'm sorry, on the left, these are required written procedures. We have a brand new one that is required to be in writing. It's called the Vomit and Diarrhea Cleanup Plan. Okay, all food establishments that serve customers, all food establishments need to have a written vomit and diarrhea cleanup plan. And it's not just having the kit on how to clean, the little tool to actually clean up the diarrhea and vomit. It's actually a written plan that talks about how you're going to do it, how you're going to make sure that staff are informed and doing it correctly. So we want to make sure you have a written plan for that. You also, though, have to have written plans if you do any of the other items. So if you refill reusable containers, maybe you like people bringing in their reusable plasticware so they can refill those inside your food establishment. You'll probably need to have a written plan for that. If you have pet dogs and you want to allow them outside of your food establishment in your general dining area outdoors, you would need a written plan. If you want to have unattended cooking, so maybe you like to cook foods overnight and no one's there, you would need to have a written plan for that on how you monitor the risks. Bare hand contact. There is an allowance in the code. If you want to have what we call bare hand contact with ready to eat foods, you would need a written plan that would be approved locally. And we have some materials for that as well. And then time is a public health control. That means you have food that you leave out at room temperature or you're not controlling the time. You can do that up to 4 hours, but you have to have a written plan for that on how you're going to handle those foods. Now, the ones on the right are a little bit more complex. They also need written plans, but they're called what we call HACCP. So they are a much more lengthy written plan. So if you package juice, if you want to reduce oxygen package foods, if you want to ferment food items, those need a written plan as well. So again, your certified food protection manager is going to help make sure that your staff are trained with a lot of those general food safety processes we talked about in section two. But section three, they're supposed to also make sure that you have the written plans that are required. So again, these are written plans that are required to be in writing, sometimes approved in advance. And that is your certified food protection manager's responsibility to make sure that those are correct and complete. So the other item that we have on this document is we talk about the facilities that are required to have it. Now, this one, we get a lot of questions about, does my food establishment need to have a certified food protection manager? And all facilities need it, except if they are what is considered a low-risk food establishment. So we try to help explain those. Traditionally, a low-risk food establishment is going to be selling only packaged foods. So maybe it's a place that has like a refrigerated case with milk. It has cheeses in it, but they're all packaged. That would traditionally be considered low risk and not need a certified food protection manager. Maybe they only make what's called non-TCS foods. So these are the foods that are not required to be refrigerated. So classic examples here, maybe they make cinnamon rolls and they don't have any foods that are required to be kept temperature controlled. Maybe they make pretzels and that's all that they do. That also is traditionally considered low risk and not need a certified food protection manager. Maybe they only heat ready to eat food. So a classic example of this is maybe you go to a gas station and get a chili and it's canned chili or hot dogs. It's canned chili, canned hot dogs, and they just heat it, they keep it hot, and then they throw it away at the end of the day. They don't cool it down. They don't do anything else with it. That would traditionally be considered low risk. And then some of our temporary events, so you go to a fair or a festival, that also would generally not need a certified food protection manager. It's short term. It's just one or 2 days. And so it's relatively low risk because of that. Okay, on the back side of the document, we also talk about the duties of the certified food protection manager. So again, we just kind of highlighted them here. It's not the full everything that they're going to do for you. But one of the key components is that they make sure that all of your written plans are current and implemented, that people are following them. So again, on the previous page, we talked about the required written plans that you have to have. You'll have some that are unique for your food establishment, but you'll also potentially have some that affects all food establishments that do that process. They have to make sure that all of your persons in charge are trained and have the knowledge. And so that's a key component. If the certified food manager is not there, they should make sure that the persons in charge have the same level so that they understand what causes foodborne illness, that they understand how to do proper sanitation, prevention of cross-contamination, that they know all of the required cooking temperatures, all the cold cooling procedures that you use, that they can train others on all of those as well, and then how to respond to emergencies and imminent health risks. on top of that, so it's not just that they have the knowledge, but again, it's that concept of that they are actually providing active managerial control. So I'll give you an example. Sometimes when I go in and do an inspection and people will ask me, well, how are my temperatures doing? And I will always say, you should know better than me on how your temperatures are, right? So you want to make sure that the individual is aware that they have food workers that are looking for temperatures, looking for food safety risks, and then reporting to the person in charge, you know, how the equipment is working, if they're seeing any trends, if they're seeing any issues. So again, really making sure that your persons in charge have the control when they are there on duty, that they are looking, actively looking for food safety risks and correcting them. And then notifying if there's something that needs a larger issue that needs to be corrected. So our document also includes some of the listed courses. At the very beginning, I told you that there are 10. There are only a few of them on here because we need to update this. We have some new providers. So again, we'll talk a little bit more later about how to get your certificate. And then we also have a list of, or a link to the current page where they're all listed. But again, you'll see that there are going to be some that have some limitations. So for example, we have a few different languages that are supported. However, we have a lot of languages that aren't. So that's another reason why we said that you could have one per establishment. Hopefully, if you have an establishment that has a lot of different languages that are spoken, you'll have someone that communicate in those languages, but they can also take the exam and get certified as a certified food protection manager. Also want to highlight that you have to make sure that they have their certificate. It needs to be on premises. It does need to be renewed every 5 years. Really key, making sure that they're looking, that your persons in charge are trained, able to hold the active managerial control when they're on shift. And also that you have the 60 days to renew the certified food protection manager if your certified food manager leaves employment. Okay, I just want to also highlight on our website, this is a little bit of a screenshot of what it looks like. We have several what we call the toolkits that you can potentially use. The one I showed you today is posted there. They're also available in multiple languages. We have them in Chinese, English, Korean, Spanish, and Vietnamese. We have documents on date marking, employee health, pet dogs, in case you're interested in that. Also the refilling consumer-owned containers, a sample vomit and diarrhea cleanup plan. They can be modified based on what you need for your food establishment. But again, you're not required to use these, they're just here as a tool for you. Also, you'll see on our website that we have an infographic, a general kind of visual for the certified food protection manager. Again, we try to highlight which facilities need the certified food protection manager. Traditionally, it's going to be a facility that, or an establishment that has raw animal products, that washes raw produce, that cools hot foods, that uses specialized processes. So maybe somebody that wants to vacuum pack or makes something like sushi where they acidify the rice, or it's a facility that serves a highly susceptible population. So these are places that have usually schools, facilities like nursing homes, senior centers, that type of facility are going to be considered as moderate to higher risk and need a certified food manager. Again, the role of the certified food manager is to train the persons in charge. Okay, the certified food manager doesn't need to be on premise at all times, but they do need to make sure whoever is the active manager on duty, what we call the person in charge, is fully trained. They also have to make sure the policies and procedures are developed. Sometimes there are requirements for written procedures and policies. Those are required. They're unique to your food establishment. So the certified food manager should make sure that those are developed, but then also making sure that they have ways to, that they are followed by the staff. And then prepare for and respond to food safety issues. So maybe they're the ones that help with recalls. They're the ones that help if you have an illness outbreak. They're the ones that help if you have some violations that are difficult to correct long-term. How to get certified. So we'll talk a little bit more about this later in the session as well, but the key that you choose an approved provider, you want to make sure that you're using an approved certification provider. I really want to make sure you're using one of the nationally accredited programs. You have to prepare and study. This is not something that you can generally just do off the cuff. You'd have to have a lot of years and a lot of understanding of quite a bit that's in the food code to make sure to be comfortable in passing the exam. Again, the point is not necessarily passing the exam, it's that you have the knowledge to be able to implement it when you come back to work. So there is a lot of preparation and study that's usually involved to get your certificate, and then practice and take the test. So the test is generally relatively long. It's much longer than the food worker card class. And so sometimes that can make people nervous. So you want to make sure that there are practice exams, ways to prepare yourself to be able to take the test. The test is what's actually certified, right? So that will be something that you will do with a provider, or generally a different way to make sure that no one is helping you when you take the test. So, and final, what our goal here is with the Certified Food Protection Manager is that you have the ability to reduce the risk factors that cause foodborne illness. That is our goal. We require a Certified Food Protection Manager per facility. We hope that they transmit that information, the training, the knowledge, the skills and abilities that they have to help the persons in charge make sure that they are able to reduce the foodborne illness risk factors. That is our end goal, the Certified Food Protection Manager. We do require that every food establishment, if they are, remember we talked about the low risk that don't have to have the Certified Food Manager, but every other food establishment has to have at least one employee that has a Certified Food Protection Manager certificate. And again, that certificate needs to be on premises of the food establishment so we know who to contact if we have additional questions. And then you can share the Certified Food Manager between establishments. So let's say you own two different food establishments. You can have one Certified Food Manager that works both, but know that both of those establishments have to maintain active managerial control. If they're not able to maintain active managerial control, we'll need to find a better way to get your Certified Food Manager able to support that. So again, I thank everyone very much for attending today. I'm very excited to see how this helps your food establishments make your food safety even stronger. I look forward to also talking over some questions that we have at the end. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Susan. We do have a couple of questions that we will ask you when we get to the end. But for now, I would like to turn this over to Shelby Pemberton, our training manager here at the Washington Hospitality Association.
Thanks, Lisa, and thank you, Susan. That was a great presentation. Like Lisa mentioned, I'm Shelby Pemberton, and I am the Training Solutions Manager for the Association. And I have the pleasure to introduce Mr. James Grigsby. He is our King County ServeSafe Manager Instructor, and he's going to delve into a little bit of what we offer for our Certified Food Protection Manager certification.
Thank you so much for that warm welcome, Shelby. I will get my screen share going and tell you all a little bit about what a day in the life of attending one of these classes looks like. Fantastic. All right, so as Shelby said, my name is James Grigsby. I am an instructor, a ServeSafe instructor, and I do several classes in the King County area and surrounding areas. I travel all over the state doing these classes for the Washington Hospitality Association, and I've been doing this since 2018. I was doing the math recently, and I want to say I'm somewhere around 5,000 students that I've had successfully go through my classes at this point and end up with their ServeSafe Food Protection Manager certification. All right. So the day of the class, it is a 6-hour class, 6.5 hour. And so it typically runs from 8:30 until 3 p.m. and starts off with introduction, logistics, and a bit of a buffer for that first half hour, getting everybody settled in and setting those expectations. Then there are three presentations. So I split the presentation into three sections. And as the day progresses, they get shorter and shorter, and followed by a lunch break and some preparation for the exam itself. And then the end of the class is the exam. At the beginning of the class, I make a point to set the attendees up for success. And so I want you to know what to expect, what you can expect from me, and what it looks like to be successful. I strongly encourage people to take notes during the class. The more active you can be as a learner during these ServeSafe classes, the more you're going to be able to comprehend it and transform it to memory and then apply it to the exam at the end of the class. Although notes aren't allowed to be used on the exam, the process of taking what you're hearing me say, what you're seeing on the screen, what you're reading in the book, the conversations you're having, and transcribing it onto paper, it is more active than passively listening. And so at the very least, take notes, something I strongly encourage. I show up and I set out about 300 pencils and several pieces of paper. I do it in the back of the class because I find that people are less intimidated to go grab it if they don't have to walk up to me to take it. And ultimately, I want everybody to pass. So just setting people up for success as much as possible. I split the presentation into three sections, as I was saying. So as the attendees' attention spans and my ability to articulate my thoughts clearly both diminish throughout the day, the sections get shorter, trying to be mindful of the learning experience. And so it is PowerPoint slides, and I make it as active as possible. And so throughout the slides, there's various questions. I will go and circle back to certain points and throw pop quiz questions at students throughout the process. I encourage asking questions, sharing thoughts, questions, wonderings, disagreements with what they're reading there, conflicts or misunderstandings. And I try to make it as safe of a space for students to vocalize those as possible. There are 10 chapters in the ServeSafe book, and so the presentation follows those chapters. I do breaks between the sections and then a lunch break at the end of the day, right before the exam. However, I don't want people to go on lunch and then come back and lose all of that information. And so as people are coming back from lunch, before we get into the exam itself, I have added a bit of review that we do. And so part of it is practice questions. I've grabbed 17 questions from ServeSafe practice materials that part of it is a reminder of certain key concepts within it that seem to be tested and come up a lot on the materials, but also part of it is understanding the question format, right? ServeSafe uses very specific language and they ask their questions in a very particular way. So helping to familiarize folks with what to expect as far as the question structure, techniques for reading it. I really encourage people to trust their instincts. So much of taking an exam like this is keeping your head high. As cheesy as it might sound, trusting your gut, following your heart is the key to success with it. At this point in people's careers, when they are taking a class such as this, you know your stuff, right? And a lot of it really is keeping that esteem up high as you're going through it, not overthinking it or second guessing yourself. The statistic is staggering. It's something like 75% of the time when you overthink and really pine over a question and change your answer at the last second, you're changing it from the right answer to the wrong answer. And so I let people know of that, right? You know your stuff. Follow your heart. I also provide a Q&A session. So if there's any questions that have come up during lunch break or anything folks are wondering about before they get into the exam, giving them the opportunity to ask that. Because once the exam starts, I shift from being an instructor, happy to answer any question, to being a proctor, where I cannot answer anything really short of, can I use the restroom or something like that. Once the exam starts, all ServeSafe knowledge coming out of my mouth stops. The exam itself. This is the big question on people's mind when the class starts. And so I actually, at the very beginning of the class, get some of this out of the way. And I hold up the paper exam and I go, all right, this is what the exam looks like. It is a physical exam packet that shows up sealed. People open it up and it has 90 questions in it. There's a separate Scantron bubble answer sheet that folks work through. And the short explanation is it's 90 questions and you need 70% to pass. The longer explanation is it's 90 questions, 10 of them are not graded. They're pilot questions. And so out of the 80 graded questions, you need 70% to pass. So that would be 56 out of 80 or higher. The exam doesn't indicate which ones are pilot questions, but I like that as, I know, a mental trick, again, for feeling good about the exam, working through it. If I get to a question I don't know, clearly this must be one of those questions that don't matter. That's why it seems a little bit wonky to me. It is a closed book exam, so the notes or SurfSafe materials or cell phones aren't going to be allowed to be used or on the desk during the exam. And then students are able to leave once the exam is finished. The vast majority of people finish the exam within 40 to 60 minutes. And so although the class takes about six and a half hours, typically people are getting out closer to the 5.5 hour mark. Again, I cannot answer any questions. I make a point to emphasize this right before we get into the exam, but inevitably I will often get people that will still try, but it gets a little awkward. But truly, I cannot answer any questions. I can't interpret vocabulary terms or anything like that. As Susan was saying, it is a very difficult exam, and my heart goes out to anybody who is attempting the exam. It goes far beyond simply decades of restaurant experience, right? It has to do with active managerial control, managerial concepts. There's a bit of virology and understanding various pathogens, microbiology components to it. And so it is not the kind of thing that somebody can just show up to and wing it. The terminology as well is very specific in the exam with SurfSafe. Once the class is over, I drop off the exam packets. I send it next day air to SurfSafe headquarters, National Restaurant Association in Chicago. They grade the exams. Typically, I see the results come usually about a week later, sometimes week and a half later. It is not very often that it takes longer than that. And then during the class, I set students up with a sheet of paper that gives them instructions for retrieving their score. SurfSafe also emails them and lets them know once their results are available. And then I let all attendees know. They're able to get a hold of myself or Shelby with the Hospitality Association to retrieve their score certificate if there's some sort of issue with pulling up your score. For example, when I originally got certified, I couldn't pull up my certificate. SurfSafe says I wrote my email address wrong. My email address is my name, but my handwriting isn't great. And so these things happen. We're able to resolve that. We can pull up everybody's score and certificate if you pass the exam. And then there are retest options available if necessary. The observed pass rate that I've seen for this is about 90% for this format of the class, where it's getting the book in advance, doing a bit of studying, attending the class, actively participating. You know, I teach few of these every single month, and it's pretty solidly about 90% of the class will pass. I've also seen plenty of people that insist, I know my stuff. I've been doing this long enough. I don't want to sit in a class all day. And honestly, that's closer to about a 50% pass rate. You are able to jump straight into the exam if you want per SurfSafe, but the odds are not as great with that. With retesting, SurfSafe has policies surrounding that. So if you do not pass your first attempt, you can take the second attempt as soon as the next day. With how long it takes for SurfSafe to grade and release the scores, by the time those results are available, you're able to immediately schedule your next exam. If somebody does not pass that one, there's a 30-day waiting period. If somebody doesn't pass that one, there's a 90-day waiting period, and you're only allowed to attempt the SurfSafe exam 4 times per year. I would imagine this because their question bank is only so big, and at a certain point, it goes from knowing the stuff to having memorized the questions, is what I would imagine the idea behind that is. I have not seen anybody fail 4 attempts, and so when people do come back and try, their scores do increase incrementally. It takes 70% to pass. A few years back when I started teaching this, it was 75% to pass. And dropping it down to 70% to pass around the time this started becoming more or less mandatory did allow the success rates to be a bit higher. I have seen a fair amount of people cruise in at about that 73%. Prior to being something that was basically mandatory, it has been the gold standard of food safety certifications. When I started teaching this, it wasn't because, you know, we were getting pressure from the FDA to have somebody everywhere that was certified. It was more of a badge of honor, right? Showing, yeah, I know my stuff. I've got the knowledge, skills, and abilities to keep my staff, my food, and my clientele safe and doing things right. And addressing several questions that I often get. So your food protection manager certification via ServSafe lasts for 5 years. It does not replace your food worker card, right? Your county, state food worker card. You still need that in addition to your ServSafe certification. Which topics are covered? There's a lot. It is very specific. And honestly, it mirrors the FDA food code very, very closely. And so there's some nuances that are very specific to this class. If somebody's late to the class itself, I recommend trying to not be late due to how difficult and specific the content is. But as long as somebody's not showing up prior to the exam itself starting, you're able to jump in and take the exam. As far as prerequisites, no, there's no years of experience requirement or anything like that. Anybody can attempt it. And why do this in person? Why take one of these classes set up by the Hospitality Association and take time off the day, not do it from the comfort of my home? The biggest reason is success rates. If I'm taking this in this setup that you all currently see me in, if I take a class such as this from my home, I'm surrounded by my favorite distractions and my favorite people. And so I am not nearly as engaged with these materials. It's easy to walk away from it, to click through the modules or videos and kind of half pay attention, half scroll on my phone. Whereas the process of going in person to somewhere with the intention of learning, of interacting with others, surrounded by peers and professionals that I've never met before that have fascinating backgrounds that I can glean and pick up knowledge from, people get a lot more out of it. There's something to be said for going somewhere with the intention of learning. Also, I like to think that I'm able to connect with people a bit better than one-size-fits-all instruction done through the computer. And so, you know, myself or any of the other instructors work with the class, answer questions, go and engage with the materials. I highly, highly encourage people to ask questions, and I keep providing that encouragement throughout the day, because the students that ask questions, that speak up, that say, hey, you mentioned so-and-so concept, here's what I'm doing in my operation, how does this apply to me? Those are the ones that I see pass. And so I really encourage people to participate. You're not having those conversations via computer. And honestly, the portal is not the most intuitive. I do see a lot of hardware issues. As somebody who recently finished schooling and have taken several online classes, it's not comfortable doing online proctoring. The system shuts you down often. I get somebody yelling at me for taking a sip of my water. It's not an ideal experience, and I don't really see optimal results from it. But there are various options, all that to say. Accommodations. So accommodations are available for the ServSafe class and exam. This is something that needs to be arranged in advance. ServSafe has a form that I would go and submit as the instructor for the class. So you would want to connect with myself or connect with Shelby, who will connect you with me, where we would go and specify exactly what the accommodation is. Ones that I've seen and done before are, for example, interpreters for foreign language. I don't speak Spanish, for example. And so sometimes having somebody there to go and interpret what I'm saying in real time can be helpful. Also, I've done a handful of classes with disability services. And so sometimes that looks like having a scribe, right, for people that are vision impaired. And all sorts of accommodations are available. Really depends on what it is, but that's something that's requested through ServSafe, and they say, yes, we can do this, or no, or we need more information, we proceed accordingly. There are a handful of different languages available, depending on the format that you're taking this. With the books, the physical books, we have English, Spanish, Chinese, and Korean. For in-person instruction, it depends on which languages the instructor speaks. Personally, myself, it is just English. I'm sorry. But yeah, it does depend on who the instructor is. For online learning through ServSafe's portal, there's English and Spanish available. The print exam is available in English, Spanish, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, French, Canadian, and large print. And the online exam is available in English, Spanish, and Chinese. Something interesting about the foreign language exams, they present the questions in both that language and in English. And so that can be helpful. The translation, there's a lot of different dialects, right? And so sometimes it can be difficult to understand what is being asked of me. And so having it available in English that the FDA food code was written in can be helpful as a point of reference if somebody has some understanding of English and their native language. And that's about all I got on this. I'm sure we'll have several questions that myself and Susan are able to speak to, but yeah, that's kind of what a day in the life of a ServSafe class looks like. Thank you.
All right. We have about 6 questions and 10 minutes to get through them. So I'm going to direct this one towards Susan. I believe you've already covered this, but I want to emphasize this point because it's come up a couple of times. Does an establishment include multiple locations?
Yes. So again, we see that a lot. It doesn't even need to necessarily be owned by the same person. So you could have 3 different establishments, all with different owners, but they use the same certified food manager. What is key again is that the intent is maintained. The persons in charge that work in each establishment is able to maintain active managerial control. They're well trained, and then they also have the required written procedures and policies that they're needed to have.
The employee requirement, and I have this asked 2 different ways. Can it be an owner, not a paid employee? Mm-hmm. And can it be an owner that is a paid employee?
Yes, it can be both. So it can be an owner. It could be a consultant that you have. It could be anyone that you as the permit holder is like, yes, this is who we want to have as our person, our certified food protection manager. So I really want to really come back to the point. I know we only have 10 minutes, but go back to the point with meeting the intent. It's somebody that you're like, yes, this is the individual that is going to best support the food safety practices inside of my food establishment. So it's not just checking the box that you have a certified food manager. It's like, yes, this is where all of my my eggs are going to be in this basket, ultimately, so that you can go, yes, this is the person I want to train and make sure. If it's you as the owner, then yes, that would be an approvable or a certified food manager.
Can we get the ServSafe book in advance of the class?
Yeah, Shelby sends those out, I believe, at least 2 weeks in advance. And
Yep, you will get your book at least 2 weeks in advance. What happens is when you register, I process that, and then I send out your packet, which includes the ServSafe book, a practice test, location, instructions, and a confirmation.
And James, you're using the ServSafe class. The national registry requires 75% to pass rather than 70%. Is that your experience? It's still 70% for ServSafe?
Yeah, ServSafe is 70%. It used to be 75%. They dropped it down to 70% around 2019, 2020. So ServSafe exam to answer that question.
When taking the test after the in-person class, is it printed or posted online? Is the
exam itself? Yeah, it is a print exam. I am able to proctor online exams as well. When it is done that way, that still has to be done with myself in person, walking around, looking at the computer screen and making sure no funny business is happening, but it can be done on a computer. By and large, we do it on print. People tend to test a little bit better doing it pencil and paper, but online is an available option, especially for retests, for example, because that does give your results immediately.
Okay. We have a questioner who has a seventh edition book. Is this the correct edition?
SurfSafe is currently on the eighth edition. However, the seventh edition book is still supported. They have materials available online and a link towards the front of your book, directing you to the right area where you would find those, that says, here's what the updates are. The seventh edition came out around 2018, and they came out with a couple updates since then. So it depends on which updated version you have, but the majority of the materials in it are still accurate. And then I address the updates and kind of point out the newer materials during these classes too.
And this one is for Susan. Why would the CFPM also need a food handler's card, and why don't they count as the same?
Okay, so perfect. So as James mentioned, this has not been required. This is a relatively new requirement in Washington State. So we've had the food worker card requirement since the 1950s. And a lot of our code that includes the food worker card actually stems from that time frame. So we are looking at updating it. I don't disagree there. But on top of that, the certified food manager goes, as James mentioned, it's very specific to the federal model food code. So it doesn't really have all of the same. Most of it's the same, but there are some unique portions that are in the Washington code that are a little bit different. So we have some additional allowances, some additional requirements. So it's not exactly the same code. So it is good to have an understanding of the Washington code as well. That's what we measure with the food worker card exam. However, I will say, I do think when we look at the food worker card rule, it's a WAC, it's a separate state law. We will look at potentially allowing it to be reciprocal or allowing it to be a substitution. But currently, the way our law is written, you have to have both.
And we discussed this the other day a little bit. When you get your certified food protection manager certification, can you extend the length of time for your food workers card?
Right. So we consider the certified food manager what we call additional food safety training. And so a lot of additional food safety trainings that are longer than 4 hours, as long as they're recent, so within the last 2 years, and when you get your when you renew your food worker card, it will extend your food worker card to 5 years. And so what's key there again is you have to get that certificate. You have to have an existing food worker card. And then when you have that certificate, you can show that, and your new renewal card will be good for 5 years.
How much is it to register for SurfSafe?
Yeah, I can answer that one. Washington Hospitality Association members receive a members only rate of $170. And for non-members, it is $240. And that's when you directly register through the association.
Is there any chance a HACCP certification will suffice for the SurfSafe?
I think that's probably geared to me because it's probably a code item and a HACCP certificate. There are a lot of great trainings out there, but that would not substitute for the Certified Food Protection Manager. It has to be a CFP, ANSI, food manager course. So that's really important for you to look at. There are a lot of great trainings out there, but you really want to make sure it's an ANSI-CFP food manager training course.
And again, we can find those on your website also, correct?
We link to them. And as we've commented here in previous chats, SurfSafe is one of the primary ones that we've seen. It's probably got the longest history that I'm familiar with. But yes, it's one of several. But again, I think it's really key to think about a lot of the ones that we have do not have a training component. And as James mentioned, you walk into that exam and it can kind of blow you out of the water if you don't have a lot of the training and the knowledge base that goes along with it. And then I also want to capture this, because this is my primary goal, is that you have to leave with the skills. It's not just the knowledge, but it's the skills and ability to apply that when you get out in the field.
All right. Well, we are at 11 o'clock. Thank you, James and Susan, so much for your time and your expertise and helping us out with this webinar today. And again, to those of you in the audience, if you are looking for, if you missed any part of this, or if you want to watch it again, it will be up on our website later on today, along with Susan's presentation slides. So thanks again, everybody, and we will see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Washington Hospitality Industry Podcast. Make sure to visit our website, wahospitality.org, where you can learn more about the restaurant and lodging industries and the Washington Hospitality Association. Be sure to subscribe to the show in iTunes, Google, Spotify, or iHeartRadio so you'll never miss a show. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Thank you so much for that effort. Until next time.